Hello and welcome once again to another Trademark podcast. My name is Stefan de Nieuwlein and I'm on my own today. I'm here to introduce a talk that we gave last week. We were invited to give a keynote talk in France, in Marseille last week. We were invited in by Industriall. It's a large trade union federation comprising 50 million members across the globe, 140 countries that engage in manufacturing and mining and energy. And the title of the conference was The Rise of the Extreme Right, and we were really pleased and privileged, I suppose, to give that talk. What you're about to listen to is that talk being given. Excuse me butchering the French language at the start of it, just my attempt at international solidarity. Hope you enjoy the talk. There will be another couple of podcasts before Christmas, so listen out for them and listen out too for the new series in the new year on imperialism, which I know you're going to enjoy because we've enjoyed recording them. So that's me. Goran Maegi, see you soon. Camarade, merci pour l'invitation d'être ici. Ça fait 30 ans que je parle français et j'oublie beaucoup. Je viens d'Irlande et bien sûr, je préférais parler en irlandaise, c'est pas possible. Et donc, malheureusement, pour vous et pour moi, je dois parler en anglais. Comrades, thanks for the invitation to speak with you here today. Thanks for the very generous introduction from the chair. Trademark is, as was mentioned earlier, part of the Irish labour movement. And traditionally, our focus has been really the peace process in Ireland, political education, and perhaps more recently, promoting kind of alternative economics and the solidarity economy, community wealth building, cooperative development, and so on. But more recently, we have, of course, been concerned, like you've been concerned, and active to a smaller degree in combating in our own small way the rise of the far right. The resurgence of the far right is, of course, one of the standout features of contemporary politics in Europe, the US, and beyond the imperialist core in India, previously in Brazil, potentially in Argentina, where they're threatening to elect a far right libertarian who apparently communes with his dead dog. It's very much a global phenomenon. But it's not entirely new either. Western support for theocratic and authoritarian regimes is nothing new. And at the moment, for example, unconditional support for Israel and its actions in Palestine is where the so-called political mainstream in the West and the far right are actually on the same page. And as someone speaking from Ireland, the authoritarian nature of so-called liberal capitalist states is nothing new. John Vorster, the South African Minister for Justice back in the 60s, said in preparation of new repressive legislation for the apartheid regime that he'd be willing to exchange all of the legislation for one clause of the Northern Ireland Special Powers Act. So perhaps what we're witnessing is rather the authoritarianism, the dispossession, the racism, the dehumanization that has been employed in the periphery of empire actually finding its way home to the metropolitan center. A case maybe of chickens coming home to roost. And of course, we don't need to remind comrades that are here from Spain and Portugal and Greece or from anywhere in Latin America of the threat of the far right, having lived through it for decades. Again, often with the express support of other Western governments. But nonetheless, there has quite clearly been a sea change in the last 15 years. And none of us can really understand the dramatic rise globally of the far right or the extreme right or whatever you want to call it, without reference actually to the global financial crash of 2008 or outside of the prevailing economic system and power relations. It's impossible and it's kind of pointless as well to try and explain the far right's reemergence without reference to the conditions of growing economic insecurity and inequality that have resulted from half a century of neoliberal restructuring of not just in, you know, of the global economy, really, you could say. Because ideas and social forces don't just emerge in a vacuum. They're shaped by material conditions. And approaching the challenges we face, the very real challenges we face from a materialist perspective, obviously gives us a better vantage point than simply kind of wringing our hands or liberal moralizing. I mean, just as the emergence and development of capitalism itself necessitated the use of racism to justify slavery and justify empire, so the emergence of fascism in the 1930s can't really be understood without an understanding of the dynamics unleashed by late 19th century imperialism, by famine in Ireland and India, by the scramble for Africa, by the slaughter of the First World War, or indeed by the social destruction of the Great Depression, which of course led to the rise of Nazi Germany. I mean, the 2008 global financial collapse is really important here, and we need to be talking about it still, and we shouldn't be forgetting about it. I'll just pull this slide up here. As you can see, the global financial collapse, and rather the bailout, took an equivalent of 50% of global GDP, which was mobilized, you know, to bail out a failed financial system. Now, those aren't our stats. They belong to the International Monetary Fund, and the IMF is no friend of the worker. Now, no equivalent mobilization, of course, took place to bail out workers or bail out communities. And that didn't go unnoticed by an awful lot of people. And rather, those people were made to carry 15 years of austerity. But it was largely ignored, I would have to say, by the establishment left, and particularly by the social democratic left. And I would argue by too many in our own labor movement, too many of whom continued and continue simply to protect the status quo from rising and genuinely legitimate anger at the system. And now what this did, of course, is it helped feed the growth of a kind of an anti-establishment, anti-politics, directed even at times at our own movement. And we're often depicted as part of the problem, as part of the establishment in some people's eyes. Whether it's true or not doesn't matter. And of course, the right, and particularly the new right, has utilized this anti-establishment, anti-politics feeling to great effect. It got, of course, a shot in the arm, excuse the pun, during COVID, with the kind of proliferation of conspiracy theories about the so-called scandemic. I mean, people are right to be skeptical of Big Pharma. People are right to be skeptical of government, but not for these reasons. And that's, of course, the difficulty of arguing against conspiracists, you know. But now it's not the odd mad one. It's legions of people promoting some of the most lunatic versions of reality. And our members, in part and in places, are buying into it. We've also seen an increase, particularly since COVID, I think, of the presence of the far right on our streets, but also particularly in our regional and now our national parliaments. And significantly, the emergence of a global online far-right networks and subcultures, which I'll get to later. I mean, too many have failed to understand, or perhaps have cynically ignored, that the neoliberal version of capitalism is breaking down amidst multiple and overlapping crises that are at once sort of economic, they're political, but they're also environmental, although that doesn't really capture the very real catastrophe facing human civilization this century. But these multiple crises are leading to a crisis of hegemony for the ruling class, a crisis of legitimacy, particularly of liberal capitalist democracies. Now, some of the ruling class are kind of waking up to the crisis. The question for us is to what extent sections of the ruling class are planning to adopt far-right ideas or make peace with the far-right, and indeed, as we've seen, go into coalition with the far-right. The so-called cordon sanitaire is practically gone, and the far right have entered coalitions and lead governments, and they're breathing down the neck of the political establishment in the very strategically important countries of France with Rassemblement National, in Germany with the AFD, and in Spain with Vox, and in other places. Of course, we still have groups, you know, modelled on the ideologies of and violent methods of 1930s fascism, like, you know, English Defence League or PEGIDA, the Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamification of Europe, and other ones. But perhaps more significant are those that I've kind of referred to that appear to have journeyed away from their fascist origins for electoral purposes, like Rassemblement, Marie Le Pen, previously the Front National. But we also see the rise of newer parties of the far right, AFD, which is polling in second place in some regions in Germany, the Sweden Democrats, which is now the second largest party in Sweden, and in government, Vox, of course, in Spain, with upwards of 10% of seats in parliament. And of course, Fratelli d'Italia, Brothers of Italy, forming the actual government in Italy. And then, of course, there's also a kind of dizzying array of think tanks and civil society organizations and online forums and networks that are constantly working to promote or influence mainstream discourse. And I'll get onto that later on. But with that, we also see something else happening, and that's a shift in the nature and the politics of traditional centre-right and traditional conservative parties. Even so-called social democratic parties aren't immune to the influence of far-right narratives. And there are kind of two main ways we see this happening. The first is what Paglietta calls authoritarian hardening, I referred to it briefly before, and we can understand this as a kind of convergence, really, of neoliberal ways of organizing the economy, but alongside that, the extension of repressive state powers that alongside kind of an increase in surveillance of workers and of activists and of NGOs, you see the severity of police responses to protests and dissent, alongside, of course, again, the introduction of repressive legislation to prevent that dissent expressing itself on the streets through marches and, of course, appearing all over the place, anti-trade union laws. And that's quite crucial for us, of course. We also see the second thing we see happening is what we might refer to as a process of mainstreaming. By that, I mean that the kind of normalization of far-right ideas and narratives in public discourse. Most obviously, of course, that occurs in the mainstream press with the growth of very powerful corporate media outlets that not just sympathize, but openly promote radical right-wing agendas. And that helps control and frame public discourse. I know the liberals don't like being reminded of it, but, you know, it's not a free press when it's owned by a couple of billionaires. I mean, as to those narratives, the ones that are being promoted across the press, in the mainstream press, I mean, the ideology of racial superiority is still very much with us, especially amongst, you know, white supremacists and Nazis. But increasingly, the kind of the new right has come to espouse what you can understand, or what we can understand, as a kind of nativism, nearly. It's kind of an ethnic nationalism, which, of course, on the one hand, strongly opposes multiculturalism and immigration. It opposes changes to the national character, wherever that is, and which kind of strongly defines outsiders, however you define outsiders, as the other and not part of us, even though the us, of course, is vaguely defined, but often just means white, let's be honest about it. And that's the one thing that links all of this, I think. It's a shared emphasis on ethnic and cultural superiority, and, of course, nostalgia, you know, nostalgia for an imagined past that never actually existed. But one that exists in memories of some people, where things were simply a lot whiter, and being a lot whiter, a lot better. Of course, you have far-right rhetoric against migrants, against minority groups, against black communities, ethnic groups of all kinds, anti-LGBT, of course, and specific kind of anti-feminist narratives form part of the picture. With, of course, on the fringes, there's still the continued presence of dangerous eugenicist ideas, like deeply rooted in extreme forms of scientific racism that take us way back to the 1930s, that, as we also know, formed part of mainstream thinking in Europe from the 30s right through to the 1970s. One of the other characteristics of the current period is perhaps the use of populism. It's important to, I think, flag up as a political vehicle for the new right and for the far right. And that's if we understand populism not as much as an ideology, but rather as a style of politics, you know. And we hear from the new right a very populist rhetoric directed particularly against the so-called elite and the other. And as I said before, we, the trade union movement, get shoved into being part of the elite. And the other, of course, is anyone they don't like. It doesn't really matter which group it is, just someone you can punch down on so as to encourage working people not to look up, not to understand the system that's destroying their lives, but to find a scapegoat somewhere further down the ladder. Much of that is wrapped up in what we understand as culture wars, you know, a struggle based not on class differences, that's crucially important, but over like values or moral codes or lifestyles, anything that is seen to damage the nation's traditional values. And again, traditional values are vaguely defined. Above all else, perhaps populism relies upon like politicizing resentment and politicizing anger. And it is sometimes a righteous anger or legitimate anger. People are angry and they're scared. And the right is the one who's benefiting from that at the moment. And the left is failing in that regard. Next slide here. Another key characteristic of today is a shift in the ideology of reaction to, and that a key element of that has been the ideology of Islamophobia, particularly, of course, since 9/11. It's been a kind of counter jihad. And of course, here we see the connection between, again, another connection between the contemporary far right and imperialism. Imperialism, if you like, treats Islam as the enemy without in the Middle East, whereas the far right sees them as the enemy within communities existing within the imperial core. But in this way, the imperialist core, again, and the far right are again on the same page. Of course, we can't discount anti-Semitism. It's still a key aspect of far-right narratives, the conspiracies about global control and Jewish influence. But the dangerous politicization of and conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism has caused, you know, and is causing, as we speak, untold damage both to the struggle against anti-Semitism and to the safety of the Jewish community wherever they exist around the world. Now, in the last few weeks, we've seen, of course, a huge increase in far-right mobilization, directly as a result of, as I said before, as Western governments' unqualified support for Israel. And we keep hearing that Israel and Palestine is a complicated situation. It's nuanced, but it isn't really, not at all. I mean, Israel isn't complicated. It's a settler colonial project and has become to represent really a beachhead for the West in the Middle East. Someone referred to it once, I can't remember who it was, it was imperialism's largest aircraft carrier in the region, with its 400 plus illegal settlements in Palestine with over 500,000 illegal settlers. It's kind of seen as a frontier of, again, European values and European civilization, whatever the fuck that is, in the Middle East. And Israel's far-right project of colonization and of annexation and of apartheid and of ethnic cleansing, as we're seeing right now, is facilitated simply because it serves the geopolitical interests of imperialism in the region. As Biden said, if Israel didn't exist, we'd have to invent it. And it's rationalized, of course, by the othering and the dehumanization and the destruction of the Palestinian people that's ongoing as we speak. And the European far right's newfound enthusiasm for Israel kind of might appear a little bit contradictory to us, you know, given the history and the ongoing reality of real anti-Semitism within its ranks. But it makes kind of sense, I suppose, as a pragmatic shift that provides far-right movements with like kind of the cover they need to reassert their Islamophobia and to exploit Palestine and support for Palestine almost as a culture war issue so that they can battle the left domestically, as we've seen very clearly in London this past weekend. And again, this is where the far right and the so-called political mainstream are on the same page, and that's dangerous. And that's what we mean by mainstreaming and normalization. And of course, not to forget, our hearts do go out, and as it does our solidarity to those currently under 24-hour bombardment across the other side of the Mediterranean here. Another standout feature of the contemporary rise of the far right is the kind of internationalization of the far right. In terms of mobilization, in terms of shared narratives, in terms of shared targets, in terms of organizational networks, and of course financing, which is a particularly dark area that needs a bright light shone on it. And we see links between the petty bourgeois fascist organizing on the one hand and elements of capital of the ruling class on the other. And we can see those links emerging if we dig deep enough. Perhaps less obvious to us, and one we wouldn't have been talking about had we had this conversation 10 years ago, is the online war and digital organizing, something that we've kind of dipped our toes into over the last couple of years. And we may have to admit, actually, that the far right have won the internet and that their digital propaganda has defeated our own. These online networks, and I'll provide links here in the presentation so you can investigate some of the reports that have come out, some of the reports that we've done. These online networks are proving to be increasingly sophisticated, disciplined, and effective processes of radicalization. We've seen over the last 5 years in particular a rapid kind of growth and proliferation of online content creators. It's important to remember, I can't remember where I read it, but apparently 90% of all of the content on the internet is created by 10% of the people. Most of us just lurk and watch, but there's a core group that produce most of the content you're looking at. And not a lot of it is coming from left-wing groups or trade unions. So there's been a rapid growth of these creators and of the networks they use, the groups and the subcultures. And all of that acts as a kind of a conveyor belt for bringing those far-right narratives into the broader public sphere and kind of public discourse. These conveyor belts also create what you might consider, I think, the academic term, you know, radicalization pathways or rabbit holes, as we'd say in English, down which individuals can and do fall down the rabbit hole. And when they come out the other end, they're often militant far-right activists who then, of course, carry those far-right ideologies and narratives into the real world, recruiting working-class adherents who are looking for answers to the very real problems, that we all face. And so we know, therefore, that social media is a battlefield, as well as the workplaces, as well as streets, as well as parliaments, as well as communities. But it's a battle on the online battle is one in which the far right is fairly sophisticated and it's persistent and it's well funded and increasingly powerful and influential, and not just powerful and influential over other people online or over the community or over communities, but it's powerful and influential over our members. We did a report, Trademark, during COVID with the help of some very good unionized worker co-ops that I should mention them, Jarrow Insight, based in London, and the Creative Workers Cooperative, based in Belfast. And it was a report on kind of lockdown discussions and the debate around lockdowns during COVID. And our findings were that about 50% of our members were supporting the state, supporting the unions, but about 50% of our members weren't. And they were supporting kind of far-right narratives about the lockdown and about COVID and all the rest of it. So we have a big piece of work to do to improve our game online. As I said before, they're years ahead of where we are. And if our response is just to print more fucking posters and more badges, then we're in serious trouble. We need to take seriously not just the power of the mainstream media, but also social media, all of which, again, are privately owned. But we still need to address some very important questions about how exactly does the right organize its forces in that space? What organizational techniques and approaches have been successful? And what's our response? What is our response to all of this? And at the moment, we're not really seeing it. Finally, of course, we need to remind ourselves and show our members that we as trade unionists and activists do respond and can respond. It's crucial that as the multiple economic crises hit and continue to hit, and they will, we continue to organize, of course, in workplaces, but not just workplaces, in communities. It's fundamental that we have links back into communities. We, of course, seriously need to look at the role of social media and big tech companies and their role in magnifying or amplifying far-right narratives, and more than that, assisting kind of mapping and countering the influence of far-right networks online with our own approaches to that space. Above all, raising political awareness amongst workers and communities must be a priority for us all in building a compelling narrative and a realistic vision to counter the far right. And part of that means sustained political education amongst representatives, activists, members, and communities. That has to be at the top of our list of priorities. But the rise of the far right and our defeat and its victory is not a foregone conclusion. I mean, trade unions around the world have been instrumental in organizing to push back the far right, to push a transformative political vision, because that's really what we need to be doing. And what's our transformative vision of the future? What's the world going to look like in the next 20, 30 years? And what's our role in making sure it's a decent world and not one in collapse? There are many examples, of course, to take inspiration from globally, as well as work being done by unions, you know, here and elsewhere. There are particular examples of successful resistance coming out of Latin America. I see your comrades there smiling in the audience, which have useful lessons for trade unions, I think, in other parts of the world. The huge victory of MAS in Bolivia in the presidential elections against a far-right military coup demonstrates the possibility of building a resilient movement from the bottom up, with, in their particular example, indigenous Afro-Bolivians, peasants, and the trade union movement all involved together. Where, you know, they focused on movement building as opposed to the curse of European politics, a narrow focus on elections only. Grassroots political education organized by workers' movements and campesino unions were kind of the foundational stone of that movement and helping it get built. And we've a lot to learn from our comrades in Latin America. Now, of course, the histories and the circumstances of these and other Latin American countries are very different to those faced by trade unions in other parts of the globe, but they highlight the necessity of, yes, industrial campaigning, but also of extra parliamentary organizing and an extra parliamentary kind of networking with other social movements. I mean, it's one of the reasons, if not the reason, why right-wing governments are really keen to clamp down on popular and public dissent and marching in streets. Why? Because it works. Because it's a form of organizing, because it's a form of education, because it brings us together and it puts us in contact with comrades across all sorts of social movements that can build the kind of movement that we need to see being built if we're genuinely going to prevent the rise of the far right and the descent into fascism. As someone once said, you know, fascism is capitalism in decay, and capitalism is in decay. Comrades, you know, I'll finish on this point. And thanks for listening. Fascism, and this is an important point to remind liberals, fascism is not a working class phenomenon. It is a ruling class project. But it trades on the weaknesses of our own and of working class organization. But combating the far right is a political question that requires a political answer. I mean, just as the far right and the right generally has grown in the absence of a socialist alternative to the obvious failures and continued failures of neoliberalism, we need to build those alternatives. It's quite clear that we're in an interregnum. We're in a period between two systems. The question for us is, what system is going to emerge victorious in the next 5 to 10 years? And at the moment, it doesn't look like we are in this part of the world. Because if the left fails to provide rational, progressive solutions to the growing social and economic crises we face, the right's going to seize the occasion with irrational and reactionary solutions to those same crises. So that's me. Thanks for listening. Goran Mikey. Well, comrades, I hope that wasn't too painful. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed giving the talk. Listen in for more podcasts on the Left Bloc platform. There's also a blog on the Left Bloc platform, leftbloc.ie, with some decent articles on it. Listen to the other podcasts, of course, The Week at Work, Nuala Nog, the ABCs of Green Politics, and a new one called North, which is a discussion about the relationships and the politics of the people on this island. Also, let's keep attending the demos, Palestine, wherever you are, go on the marches. If you can't go on the marches, your presence online is important. Every tweet you send out, every Facebook post you make, every TikTok video you make, keep doing it. It all matters and it all helps. Comrades, Slán go fóill.